occasionally hold conferences. My wife went to one recently in which they basically recommend that when you become hospitalized, that you do not become a patient, that you do things to make you stand out, so they give you consideration. A whole lot of recommended things that you're supposed to do, so you're not just a thoroughly compliant patient where they don't give you proper attention. I won't get into that right now. Howie, I know you wanted to go into something. Go right ahead, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. You know, you were talking, when Mel was talking about admittance and taking the reciprocal of the impedance, why I think it's better to use, do every, you know, when you're using a Smith chart, when you're normalizing and everything, and go from rectangular to polar, because when you're changing something, when you got an inductance, that inductance now has a negative number. It has a negative angle. When you have, when you are dividing, you change the sign, you know, in the polar coordinate. So I think mentally it's better to think when you divide in polar, and when you add in, you know, rectangular. And when you want to multiply, you multiply in polar. That means if you multiply, it's almost like logarithmics. You know what I'm saying? You add the angles, and you multiply the magnitudes. Go ahead, Dick.
I'm going to agree with you, Howie. If I was doing all my calculations by hand, and if I was foolish enough to leave everything in the impedance format, where I've got an R and an X on top, an R and X on the bottom, and I got to do a division. There's only about 10 ways you can make a mass error in the complex math, meaning it's got imaginary numbers to it. That's what we mean by complex. There's about 10 ways you can make errors, particularly errors in signs as well as errors in magnitudes, when you do that by hand. However, so therefore, if you flip over to, if you accurately flip over to polar first, then do the division, you're only dividing magnitudes, and the angles are very easy to handle. But if you're using a modern-day handheld calculator, you can skip the steps of converting from rectangular to polar, do the math, and then convert the polar back to rectangular. You can skip over all of the polar intermediate steps if you've got a modern handheld calculator like Hewlett-Packard 28S or Hewlett-Packard 48 or 49. Those series of now obsolete machines, from my point of view, do a better job working in rectangular than they do in polar. Anything you put into those machines into polar, you must first go through the step of rectangular so that the machine can do its form of mathematics. And when it does a conversion of an R and an X on top and an R and X on the bottom, and it does the division of that fraction, it does it very accurately. It doesn't make the mistakes. You and I may make mistakes entering the data into the machine and create a garbage-in, garbage-out situation, GIGO. But the machine doesn't make the math errors that a human being with pencil and paper. You and I were taught how to do complex math with pencil and paper because it wasn't until I was more than 10 years in industry that I had easy access to a handheld calculator that did a good job of handling complex mathematics. Back to you, Howie. KQLIW.
I'm back to you.
Rich recognized, you got it, Howie.
I agree with you that you should do that, but you mentally have to realize what's happening. You know, what I think happens is, yes, if you're learning this, you should do it my way. When you're out in the field, you can use a calculator. But Mel was not explaining that you were, you know, he just said divide, and he wasn't really saying, okay, well, you know, he didn't explain what was happening in between. Because you realize angles are changing, the magnet, the polarities are changing, you know, that an inductor now will be like, in a, you know, capacitor, it'll have capacity, you know, it has the, you know, it goes to a minus sign, the emittance and substance. So I really feel you need to really get a feel for what's happening. And I don't know, would you still use a Smith chart today? You can have programs that will tell you the length of it. I don't know, does anybody really use a Smith chart today? It's good to understand it. It's good to know how to use a Smith chart, but to get a real accurate measurement of lengths and stuff like that, I would rather use a computer program. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, I got a couple of comments on all of the above, Howie. Because of what's going on with Mel, Dick, and Howie, the people who listen can decide to do it more in rectangular or more in polar, whichever they're familiar with. As long as you carry out all the, dot all the I's and cross all the T's, as long as you carry out all the steps correctly, each method will give you the right answer. Each method can give you the answer with whatever accuracy you require. When you're using computer programs, most of the good computer programs display the data with a Smith chart, display some of the operations with a Smith chart. When you're using a network analyzer, the best machine in the world in the 21st century for making measurements, stand by a second, the best machine in the world for making measurements of what's going on with your transmission line, your amplifier, your antenna, whatever you're doing in the RF world, you're 90-some-odd percent of the time nowadays in any well-equipped laboratory, you will use a network analyzer. Almost every single network analyzer displays the data in a Smith chart if you request that. You can force the machine to display the data numerically as an XY plot of reflection coefficient, standing wave ratio, the real component, the imaginary component. You press the right button, you can get the display in whatever form is your favorite. The form that most people use is either magnitude of reflection coefficient in a rectangular decibel graph, XY graph. That's an extremely popular method of display. Standing wave ratio is the second most popular display, and Smith chart is the third. If you're doing snowflaking, let me drop and explain that. On modern day microwave amplifiers, the first thing somebody a zillion years ago discovered is that, gee, you got a little bit of a mismatch at the input, and you're not getting quite the right impedance match and gain at the output, and you're not getting quite the right stability. The first thing some smart engineer did when it comes to solid state circuitry a whole lot of years ago is he stuck his finger in there to see what happens. And he suddenly realizes he puts his finger in a certain place and the display gets better. The gain goes up. The impedance match gets better. And pretty soon he takes tiny little chunks of copper foil, the one-sided glued copper foil. He takes a whole bunch of little pieces he cuts up with a small set of scissors, and he takes some kind of sticky substance like glue or gunk or whatever, this kind of paper-sticking glue. I can't think of the name of the darn stuff now. Prit. He takes a little piece of prit, he puts it on the end of his toothpick. He picks up a tiny little piece of copper, and he brings it near the microstrip circuit, solid-state circuit. And he slides it along the microstrip, and he suddenly realizes there's certain locations where he puts that little piece of copper, everything gets better. And then he solders it down or glues it down to that location. That process is called snowflaking. You would be amazed how much fine-tuning of modern-day circuits takes place by way of snowflaking. When a person is doing snowflaking, 90-some-odd percent of the time, he is watching a Smith chart. He doesn't want to know that the overall magnitude of standing wave ratio got better, or the overall magnitude of reflection coefficient got better. He wants to see, there are certain places where he puts the snowflake, and the Smith chart winds in a certain way. His previous experience tells him if he puts the first piece of snowflake there and winds the Smith chart one way and then puts the second piece of snowflake a little bit further downrange, he's now going to hit home plate in a two-step process. So with the Smith chart, he's getting amplitude and phase information all together in one display. And a smart guy looking at that with snowflaking experience gets to home plate a hell of a lot faster. Which is the best display? Yes, all of them. Depending on what you're doing, every one of those displays has merit. And a modern-day good network analyzer made by Agilent, Hewlett-Packard, Rodenschwartz, Inritsu, any of the good brand names, you press the right button, and it'll give you the display in whatever is your favorite. Let me give one other example of what I'm saying. When it comes to cascaded noise figure of low-noise amplifiers to be connected to an antenna, you can use the cascaded noise figure formula where you know the noise figure of each stage, the gain of each stage, you plug it all into this formula, and it tells you the overall noise figure of the system. And then you want to find out, gee, am I a little bit too low in gain of the first stage, or am I a little bit too high in noise figure of the second stage? And you start playing with the numbers to try to find that out. That's the conventional way to do it. A smarter person doesn't do cascaded noise figure formula. He does cascaded noise power density accumulation. Another branch of mathematics studying noise figure. And now you see the detriment or benefit of each individual stage as you study that stage with that set of formulas. Is one more accurate at telling you the overall best noise figure you're ever going to get with that chunk of hardware that's in front of you? They both have merit. Each has its strengths. A smart person learns noise figure in at least two or three different methods of studying it with different mathematics. A person studying standing wave ratio, to get back to what you and I are talking about, does he want polar, does he want rectangular, does he want Biswar, or does he want decibel magnitude or reflection coefficient? Which one does he want? Or does he want pure resistive component and pure reactive component, the imaginary component, or the real component graphed? A smart guy wants all of those, depending on which one he's doing. And a modern machine gives that to you. So, you and I can argue, is it tomato or tomato? And each has merit in the pronunciation. Is it centimeters or centimeters? Which one of those displays is the best one? If you've got the time, learn them all. Each one has benefit in certain situations. That's an opinion. Back to you, Howie. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY with a comment.
Hold on, Howie. Mel first, go ahead.
Well, you've got November QST, open page 38 and 39. Tell me what you think.
I don't have that issue in front of me right now, Mel. It's in the other room. It's in the pile of stuff alongside of the sofa that's got to be read immediately. I'm laughing at myself. Mel, if I open that up, tell me what I'm going to see.
Smith charts. 1, 2, 3, 4. There they are. That's it. So 67 years after Mr. Smith, here we are. Fortunately, there's a very easy way to analyze your complex loads using graphical methods called the Smith chart. And basically, here they are using the Smith chart. They have a whole bit of little things that we touched upon here and there about the Smith chart. And so here you are. Still, they recommend using the Smith chart to understand antennas, Dick, over.
Beautiful. And QST tries to be not at the cutting edge, but at least in the modern world of wireless. And there's another thing I'm going to mention to you, Howie. We just hired a real good engineer who's only a small number of years out of school about 2 months ago at my main place of business, and we're about to hire a second one. In both cases, they come out of the electrical engineering schools with a whole lot of study and experience under their belt with reference to using a particular computer modeling program for wireless circuitry. And I have seen it time and time again where they're not quite sure what the program is doing. They just plug in the numbers and get an answer. And there are times when they will plug in two resistors in parallel. I'm using a ridiculous example here. Two 1-ohm resistors in parallel, and they'll get an answer of 1 milliohm. And because they're not familiar with doing back-of-the-envelope product over sum of calculation for a parallel resistance rule, they don't know that that's ridiculous. Each of those people doing wireless radio calculations, plugging data into the program, if they don't put in the data in exactly the right format with the right units in the right spot at the right time, they get answers that look beautiful to them, but they're crazy. What each of the guys who are seasoned electronic engineers frequently do is ask the guy, hey, I know for historic reasons in your classes you were told how to use a Smith chart, but they didn't emphasize that anymore as they used to in the old days. And if you do the answer simultaneously on a Smith chart, you'll know right away that the answer you got out of that computer program was crazy. You need backup. I don't care if it's the back of the envelope calculation. I don't care if it's a Smith chart. I don't care if it's a little handheld program that you wrote in your handheld calculator. To take the respective program that somebody spent $1 zillion for, like HFSS or something else, or MathCAD or any of these other programs, each of these programs are capable of giving you beautiful-looking answers that are crazy. Without a backup, you could commit a company into a manufacturing process that could turn out to be very expensive until the error is discovered. And so before you commit a manufacturing process, you better have done the calculation by at least two methods, one theoretical and one graphic, and they better come out in the same ballpark. if not find out why, before you commit to a whole bunch of bucks being spent, a whole lot of man hours being spent. That's the suggestion. Back to you, Howie.
I absolutely agree with you. Whenever you do an engineering problem, you want to do it two different ways, and you want to see if you come to the same conclusion. You want to show your work in two different ways, so that, okay, I got to this number this way, or this assumption. And I absolutely agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think it's important to use a Smith chart. I think it's good to understand, as you're doing all these conversions, to have a feel for what's happening with the angles and all of that stuff. But a Smith chart is very important. I don't think 99% of people know how to use a Smith chart. I have to say one thing. Pratt was one of the very few schools that really taught us how to use Smith charts. Over to you.
Oh, yeah. In that so-called advanced electronics course that was taught by Boyette in the senior year, and I think it was a one-semester course, seemed to me like he spent a solid third of the semester having us manipulate that Smith chart in about five different ways. And it appeared over and over again on the exams. So he, being a man who had worked 3 years at Bell Labs in the field and then went back to teaching, realized the power of it. However, I can see what's happening. Modern-day computer programs, modern-day network analyzers, so much of the process in an automated manner that not as much Smith chart instruction is taking place in modern-day engineering schools. And that's a little bit sad. You got advantages and disadvantages. When I was in high school, they spent a whole lot of time teaching me how to cast out by twos in order to do a long division process in order to manually take square root. Nowadays, a $5 calculator has a button called square root, and you press it, and you got square root. So should we spend 2 or 3 weeks in the algebra class learning how to take square roots manually nowadays? Probably it's no longer justified. You could better spend the time doing something else. And maybe to a degree that's happening with electrical engineering, they are de-emphasizing the Smith chart. But if you learn it, it's one more tool, it has value. I think it's worth making the investment. For us who are going to work with transmission lines for the rest of our lives, it's very rare, let me jump, it's only a very rare situation nowadays where the transmitter and the antenna are co-located. Inside a satellite, that's sort of true. And when it comes to a 10 gigahertz converter, you put the box behind the dish up on top of the tower because you can't tolerate the transmission line laws. So there the transmitter and antenna are almost co-located. But even there, you've got a couple of feet of waveguide or whatever. And so in almost all real situations, there is a significant number of wavelengths in a transmission line between the antenna and the transmitter. Therefore, learning transmission line theory is darn valuable. And a Smith chart is a darn good tool to learn and understand and visualize transmission line theory. So for a bunch of reasons, Mel and I, and probably Howie, are fairly convinced it's a worthwhile investment. Therefore, we're making the investment. For those who can tolerate to listen to us, we think they're going to get something out of it. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback in the emails I get, and almost all the mail that Mel's getting is positive feedback. About the only negative I think he's gotten recently is a few people are a little bit unhappy that a lot of bucks are being spent on the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope. K2KEY, K2HIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, I have in front of me one of the greatest things ever written called Another Look at Reflection by Walt Maxwell. I'm sure you're familiar with that. He has in there a Smith chart called the W2DU Reflection Mechanics Vectograph. If you want it in a concise story of matching SWR, incident foliage, reflected foliage, refracted, I want to know about it, Dick. Anything you want to know about, he's got that so concise that looking at this one picture is literally, like they say, worth a million words, over.
Yeah, Walt Maxwell is one of the real valuable older electronic engineers, RF men. I'm pretty sure he was an employee of RCA Astro. I think it's in Camden, New Jersey. He was on the Tyros weather satellite project of RCA Astro. And so The problem he had is that they were building a 136 megacycle antenna on that satellite to transmit down the weather data that was being picked up by the camera on that satellite. It was a tape measure type antenna. In other words, the antenna was a quadrupole of great big pieces of the steel tape that you've got in your expanding tape ruler. That was wrapped around the satellite. A squib was cut when it went into space, and the antennas popped out into four separate, into a turnstile-like antenna. And the antenna itself, these four pieces of tape sticking on the outside of that satellite, had a reasonably poor standing wave ratio. The conventional wisdom at the time was you had to impedance match at the antenna, because if you did it on the far end, on the transmitter end of the transmission line, you would end up with a lot of extra loss. But where the tape measure came at the edge of the satellite was a very critical piece of hardware, and there wasn't a volume in that area where you could put a protected impedance matching circuit network. He did it back at the transmitter, some number of wavelengths down the transmission line, and he got a lot of flack from his fellow engineers because they were not following the instruction that they were given in the schools that they went to when they dropped. So he insisted on putting the impedance match for the antenna right at the transmitter, at the input end of the transmission line. There's only a few wavelengths of transmission line, but still, that's where he did it. And his fellow engineers were predicting all kinds of disaster. They put the satellite in a great big anechoic chamber at RCA Astro. They measured the efficiency of the antenna system, and they said, holy cow, how the hell did he do that? How did he pull that off? Walt had a good gut feeling of how reflected power really worked on transmission lines and mismatch antennas. And he used that to his advantage. And so your antenna tuner, as long as your transmission line is low enough in loss, your antenna tuner located in the shack can do an excellent job. And Walt demonstrated that on multiple occasions throughout his 35-year experience in the RF world. Now, this beautiful W2DU Reflections article you're reading, is it Walt's book or an article out of QST? What's the reference, and is there a website on that one? Mel, go ahead.
I downloaded the whole thing. I have the book, but this is in the, you know, in the order. It's printed, I think, in QST. Another look at reflection. I guess you go to the QST, let's see, when was the series? The series appeared in 1973, April and June of 1973, August 1973, October, April, December 1974, etc. American Radio Relay League. The series was completed as the book called Reflections. This is the complete amateur radio, more or less, bent towards amateur radio excerpts from his book on reflection. But I'll tell you, Dick, it is so well written. And it's, and of course he just also mentions, it also mentions at the beginning who Walt Maxwell was, about his work with the Tyros and Estes weather satellites, Echo 1, and the design of Apollo's lunar rover, the moon buggy, Earthlink antenna system, and his work with RCA. He developed and started the RCA Astro Electronics Division. So in the article, it says here, the beginning of the article, it says, it's the understanding this and my algebraic expressions and manipulations of the Smith chart are an important way to understand complex loads, Dick, over.
Algebraic stuff is important, understanding the algebra.
Oh, yeah. And not too many people have been given a course in imaginary mathematics, the square root of minus one. That's a fancy way of mathematically representing a 90-degree phase shift. Up and down, you could call it the simple graph of resistance. Left and right, you could call it positive and negative phase shift, or impedance, the reactive component, and the complex mathematics, the square root of minus one, the I or the J, depending on which symbol you use for it, is a way of mathematically representing that. Now, I'm going to hit both of you guys, Howie and Mel, with an overly restricted problem. Mel, you just gave a good demonstration tonight of using a Smith chart to put up a stub in the right location on the transmission line and the right length of stub so that you took your antenna, which was 32 ohms of resistive component and 20 ohms of inductive reactive component. That was your antenna, and you corrected it. Now I'm going to ask you a more difficult problem. For whatever reason, you're not allowed to touch the transmission line. It's got to stay the exact same impedance, the exact same length, and you're not allowed to touch it. Your antenna is 32 plus J20. I want it to end up as 50 J0. Whatever you're going to do, you're going to do it right at the dipole. Assume the antenna is a dipole. I'm going to ask each one of you guys in sequence, if that overly restricted problem, you are forced to do something right at the dipole, as simple as possible, to make 32 plus J20, 32 ohms resistive, 20 ohms reactive. That's what the antenna is right now of that dipole. And I want you to make it 50 ohms resistive and J0. And you're going to do it right at the antenna, right at the dipole itself, and you're going to do it as simple as possible on that overly restricted problem. How would you approach it? Mel first, you got it.
Use the angle of the antenna stick.
Okay, if you choose the right angle of the antenna, you're going to make a change of the resistive component, and you're going to make a change of the reactive component, but that alone ain't going to correct both of them. It'll move you in the right direction, but it won't get you all the way to home plate. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, well, other than that, what else can we do? Let's see. I don't know. Can we hang any components on there, or just got to do it just by manipulating the wire over?
I'm going to let you choose to either manipulate the wire or add a single lumped component, which eventually you could make it into a stub, but a lumped component. I'm going to let you add one single lumped component, and I'm going to let you play with the wire. What would you do?
In a case that were like we did, where the antenna was slightly inductive, we could put a capacitance across it and slightly alter the, the capacitance, let's see. We put a capacitance and then we could adjust the angle. I think you could most likely find then a fairly close match over.
Okay, you've got 20 ohms of inductive reactance. I think you're telling me you're going to put something like 20 ohms of capacitive reactance right across the antenna to kill the reactive component. You basically said that. And the 32 ohms of resistive component at the same time is going to change a little bit, but it's not going to quite go to 50. You're very close. I see what your approach is. Let's see what Howie's approach is. Howie, how would you approach that? You're allowed to play with the antenna. You're allowed to put one fixed lumped component right at the antenna terminals. And you want to end up at 50-0 when you're at 32-20. Back to you, Howie.
Well, I could add two ways I can do this. I could add capacitors at the end of the antenna, like head capacitors, or I could play with a piece of coax, tie a piece of coax at the feed point and let it hang, and then you're cutting it, either a shorted or an open stub. Most likely I would use a shorted stub and play with the length and keep moving that until I found the best match.
Okay, you're close to right. By the way, adding capacitor top hats at the end of the antenna, let me backtrack. Since Mel's example was 32 ohms resistive and 20 ohms positive reactance, the fact that the reactance is positive, inductive, means the antenna is already electrically too long. You added capacitor top hats at the end, you would make it even longer, electronically. Okay. So 20 ohms would go to 30, 40, and 50, it would climb. So it's not quite the right direction. You're both close. And I've tried on multiple occasions to publish an article on this exact subject. And each of the places where I submit the article, they think it's too simple, that everybody knows how to do it, that the information is too boring, and they refuse to publish it. So it got published online. If you go to www.wa1mba.org, I'll give you that phonetically, www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. That's the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA. Go to the bottom of his webpage, going through right now, his first web page, and two items from the bottom. The second item from the bottom is called Yagi Impedance and Matching Info, the Element Lens for the Junior Boomer. That's the name of the article. Tap on that, and you're going to find something called Yagi Technical Information by K2RIW. You click on that, you're going to find an article. And the article is both two pages of explanation, followed by two charts that you can click on, a resistor chart and a reactor chart. What is this chart telling you? I'm running out of time. Let me drop. The best-kept secret about dipoles, that every dipole resistive component goes towards 0 ohms as you make the dipole shorter than half-wave. Every dipole, the resistive component, goes to a few thousand ohms if you make it longer than half-wave and you start approaching full-wave. So there is a magic length of every dipole, no matter what you make it out of, no matter how you tilt it, no matter how close to the ground it is, no matter how close to a sheet of metal it is, no matter how you zigzagged it, no matter what you did with the dipole, whether you made it out of thick wire, thin wire, tapered wire, whatever. As you change the length of a dipole, the resistive component will continuously, smoothly, go from 1 ohm resistance to more than 2,000 ohms resistance. Choose whatever number in between you like. I don't care if you're using 35 ohm coax, 50 ohm coax, 70 ohm coax, 300 ohm tin lead, 600 ohm open wire line, does it matter? You choose the right length of your favorite materials and your favorite way of laying out the dipole. You choose the right length, and you will always pass through exactly your favorite resistive component. If you're using 300 ohm twin lead, you'd like the resistive component to pass through 300 ohms resistive. Choose the right length, and you will get exactly there, to the nearest milliohm if you want to do it. That's the good news about the resistive component. The second chart that's in that article is that almost always you have a reactive component left over. Put a simple shunt capacitor of the right value at the center of the dipole, and the reactive component goes away. So the process is, choose the right length and add a capacitor at the center. And it could be a simple gimmick capacitor right across the terminals. Simple as all hell. Let me drop. Now, why this is so darn important is that every single Yagi that anyone has ever built for high performance, I don't care if you're doing meteor scatter, long-range tropo, moon bounce, whatever, every Yagi has a driven element impedance that's crazy, typically 15 to 20 ohms resistive. When you tune all those directors and reflector and everything else of the antenna, I don't care if you've got a trigonal reflector, I don't care if you've got a super long Yagi or short Yagi, whatever, you end up with some impedance of the driven element that you don't like. In order to correct that, people try all kinds of techniques. Folded dipole, T-match, L-match, gamma match, I'm trying to think of some of the others, delta, gamma, T, folded dipole, all kinds of ways to try to get close to the right ballpark. They never get there. Doesn't matter how you set that driven element. Choose the right length. The resistive component becomes your favorite impedance. Add a capacitor across it, and you're there at 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Reflection coefficient 30 dB down. Why is that important? Not for efficiency reasons. Whenever you carefully tune that low noise amplifier, and it gives you that beautiful half dB noise figure that you tried so hard to get, that half dB noise figure exists if and only if the input of that preamplifier sees 50 ohms resistive with no reactants. Make the input of that low noise amplifier that you carefully tuned up on your automatic noise figure indicator, which is a pure 50 ohm noise generator, make that beautiful LNA look into any other impedance, and its noise figure will worsen, sometimes by a whole lot. And if you're doing moon bounce and you need the nearest tenth of a dB to succeed, every tenth or two-tenths of a dB of noise figure change makes the difference between a QSO and a non-QSO. Therefore, every Yagi, every dipole that mankind has ever created can be made a perfect impedance match if you just juggle the length a little bit and add a capacitor across the center. Once you understand those two charts that were published in the Antenna Engineering Handbook way back in 1982. Correction, was it 1970? Whenever Henry Jasser came out with the first one. I think it was around 1970, 1972. the first edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Those curves for dipole resistive component and dipole reactive component have been there for 30 years, and people didn't understand what it was saying. Every dipole can be a simple, perfect impedance match. You don't have to fiddle around with any of these fancy mechanical things. Everyone thinks you have to. And they also think one-to-one is unachievable. It's easy as all hell if you know what you're doing. That's an approach. K2RIW listening.
Dick, what is the actual length? A halfway dipole give you 75 ohms. What, 50 ohms? You don't want to change the angle. What is the actual difference?
Good question. In pure free space, a very, very thin wire dipole have exactly 95% of half wave, because there's a little bit of end loading capacitance. That's why it's not exactly half wave. 95% of half wave will be 72 ohms resistance and no reactance. As you make it a little bit shorter, instead of 95%, I don't know the exact number, it's probably going to be 91%. And I can find out by looking at that chart. You go to that website, you look at the chart, it is there. And by the way, the chart is every possible diameter of wire you would possibly use is on that chart. You choose your diameter. I don't care if it's a quarter inch diameter rod for your 2 meter Yagi driven element, or if it's a piece of 35 gauge, infinitely thin, invisible dipole you're hanging in the backyard so that the lanyard doesn't see it. All of those diameters are on that chart. Choose the right line of the chart and choose the right length, and it'll tell you exactly what length will get you 50 ohms. And maybe it's 91% of a half wavelength, because 95% of a half wavelength is 72 ohms. That's where it's resonant. You do that, and now it's a little bit short of the usual length in order to make the resistive component get exactly right. You then hang the reactants across it to get rid of the reactive component, and you're there. And the chart doesn't tell you a tilted dipole, in other words, an inverted V dipole. The chart doesn't include that. These are straight-out dipoles. The chart is really a monopole chart, but you have to remember that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back-to-back, and you didn't bother putting in the ground plane. So there is a length you can get off that chart that will make it exactly your resistive component of whatever transmission line you're using. Back to you, Howie.
The only thing is when you use a capacitor or shunt it, now your frequencies, you can't move too far off of wherever you calculated the stuff from.
There's a yes and no to that, Howie. The basic dipole itself, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's 5% bandwidth at the 2-to-1 point. And when you do this phenomena, if you used to have a pure dipole at 5% bandwidth and you do what I'm recommending, you got 4.5% bandwidth. You've increased the Q, but by a very small amount. That's spitting in the ocean. That's minor. That's not the showstopper. The showstopper is that people don't realize you don't need all these fancy doodads. Read that article. I'm going to assign that as homework for the both of you, and we'll discuss it next week if you want to. Thank you, Howie.
The question.
Go ahead, Mel.
What happens if we made the wire more resistant? Instead of using copper, use some other material with more resistance in the line. What would happen then?
Good question. Let me answer it in two steps. Everyone wants to believe a half-wave dipole with thin wire in free space is 72 ohms. Everyone wants to believe that the signal comes out of the transmission line, goes crawling along that wire, sees 72 ohms as it does it, and gets radiated into space. If that was true, I'd put a clip lead on the end of the wire, make it a little bit longer. Since the signal has already been radiated into space, nothing would happen. Put a clip lead on the end of that wire, make it a little bit longer, and all of a sudden you've got a fierce vizlar. We've all seen that phenomenon. That's a very strong message. We didn't get the message. The message is the signal will bounce back and forth roughly 30 times on that wire before it finally gets radiated into space. What you and I call resonance is to make sure that the 30 bounces all stay co-phase. They're all lockstep. You've got to carefully choose the right length so that they all don't shift in phase and start getting late or early because it's too short or too long. Resonance is choosing the right length so that all the bounces stay co-phase. Now you make the wire out of resistance, and you've got the signal bouncing back and forth through that resistor 30 times. You're going to lose a whole lot of signal. The bottom line is you've made a pad. Whether you put the attenuator in the transmission line, or you make it a distributed attenuator along the wire, you've done the same thing. you'll get the right, the exact same VISWR versus frequency. You'll get the right, the same decrease in efficiency. You'll get the exact same amount of energy being burned up in the heat by your attenuator. You can put the attenuator on the wire. You can put the attenuator in the transmission line. You have done the same thing. Ain't that crazy? K2KEY, K2RIW and TechNet. We're running out of time. We got to be careful.
Not running out of time. Well, no, what I was thinking, if the wire was resistive, let's say instead of using copper, we used a wire, some kind of iron wire that has a the resistance of the wire itself is higher resistance than copper. Wouldn't that make the antenna more broadband thick?
Boy, that sounds beautiful. You'd be amazed how many people have been sucked into that one, Mel. As you may know, the early rubber ducks were made out of nichrome wire because it made them more broadband, and the VISWR got better. If you studied the insertion loss by making the rubber duck out of nichrome versus the exact same number of decibels of loss by putting a pad in the transmission line up to the rubber duck, you get the exact same increase in bandwidth. You get the exact same improvement in standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio means the antenna is not quite resonant and some of the energy is reflecting back to you. You can either absorb the energy reflecting back to you by putting a pad in the transmission line, or you can absorb the energy that would have reflected back to you by putting a pad in the rubber duck or in the dipole. Intuitively, it sounds like putting the nichrome wire, the resistance distributed in the antenna, should be better. Good common sense. Dead wrong. The physics is the same. That's the craziness of this RF world. Whether you put the pad in the antenna or the pad in the transmission line, you get the exact same increase in VISWR of bandwidth. The VISWR bandwidth goes up, the VISWR goes down, because you're absorbing energy that would have reflected back to you. The exact same amount in both cases. I know it sounds crazy. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, because I was wondering, how the heck they do it with the rubber duck? How do they get the bandwidth on the rubber duck? First of all, how do they get these rubber ducks to operate both, when it comes to the radio, 2 meters and 70 centimeters, and have the bandwidth? I the only way I could come up with the answer was basically that they're using some kind of resistive type of antenna.
No, they just don't care what the SWR is. These radios can handle a wide SWR.
You're both right. In the early days, it was made out of nichrome wire until the hams started discovering this and the efficiency was going down and they all hit the ceiling and wouldn't buy that brand name. The manufacturers got smart. All the rubber ducks now are made out of copper-covered steel, nichrome, whatever you like, but the antenna itself is efficient. The antenna runs ice cold. The rubber duck runs ice cold these days. There's at least three approaches. Number one, the rubber duck is fundamental on the low frequency and it's running on the third harmonic on the high frequency, 2 meters versus 450. That's one approach. The second approach is that the antenna, the rubber duck, is reasonably good at 2 meters. It's got a fierce VISWR at 450, but they've done impedance matching on the 450 transmitter. Back at the transmitter. Doesn't matter. It still radiates. The pattern out there on the third harmonic is a little bit more lobey, a little bit more lumpy, but a guy with a handy talkie in his hand, the damn rubber ducky is always waving, his hand is moving, the lobes are moving in space, he never gets a continuous null. So, doesn't matter. The antenna itself must be efficient because we amateurs have demanded it. If that rubber duck has the slightest amount of heat, we're going to hit the ceiling, and we're not going to buy that brand name. So they forced the rubber duck to be efficient. Now you can get a little bit sexy by winding the rubber duck with one diameter at the base and a smaller diameter at the top. You can flip back and forth between diameters, wide spacing of the turns, narrow spacing of the turns, a little bit of a whip inside. Maybe you can even hang a fixed capacitor or a stub in there. There's ways you can make the antenna a little bit different. But because there are such great ways of impedance matching, no matter what the hell the antenna is, and that's what Maxwell's been telling us, that's what an antenna tuner's been telling us, that's what these articles are telling us, as long as the antenna will radiate at all, you can impedance match it somewhere, right at the base of the antenna, inside the box, right back at the transmitter, doesn't matter. If you're smart enough, you can make it work. Mel, you got it first. We're running out of time.
They use a little cap at the bottom.
That's one approach, but that only fixes it at one frequency, not the other. You got it, Mel.
So tell me another thing. You know, the rubber ducks are not interchangeable from radio to radio. If you buy certain ICOM radio, and when a replacement, you got to give them the model number of the radio. You can't just, there's no such thing to rub a duck off the shelf pick over.
You're absolutely right, and I'm very glad you said it, because each manufacturer chooses his favorite length and resonant frequency of his rubber duck, and then the impedance matches it at the transmitter. Each guy has chosen a slightly different rubber duck for whatever reason. Therefore, you choose rubber duck from brand A, and you put it on brand B, it's not quite as good. It doesn't die, but it's not quite as good, because they're doing the impedance match inside the box, not in the rubber duck. The rubber duck is not universal. You're absolutely right. I bet you've run into this one also, Howie. Is that true?
You also got to know that a lot of these radios don't want to work that well into outside antennas. I don't know. Some of the newer radios are all 50 ohms, but what they're doing now is I think they're building like little traps where you're right. They have a 440 coil, and then somehow go to 2 meters. Now the whole antenna is used.
You got it. And by the way, if the rubber duck itself was 31 ohms of resistance and 20 ohms of reactance at the base of the rubber duck, and the impedance matched to that, and then with a BNC cable you connect it to an outside beautiful antenna that's 50 ohms, in that environment you've got a 2.5 to 1 or a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. You've lost half a dB because of the 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. When you're listening to your favorite repeater, if the S meter is a half dB further down, 1/12th of an S unit on a well-calibrated S meter, 6 dB per S unit, you would never know the difference. You got it, Mel?
Okay, now to take the rubber duck. In other words, the ring, the outer ring, the locking ring of the BNC connector, the BNC type, is doing nothing. It's going nowhere. Is that correct?
You got it. It is a mechanical support structure. Electronically, it is not there on 99% of all the rubber ducks you and I can buy. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. That's why I came up with this other antenna system. I have to show it to you somewhere we'll meet up. I have to show you an idea that I came up with an antenna that I put on the handy talkie and makes it much more efficient and doesn't poke up and kill you when you walk. In other words, with the rubber duck or any of these antennas stick up on top of the radio, it kills you when you walk or bend. You're going to bend it or gets in your way. So I came up with another idea. It works just as well, but I have to show it to you sometime, Dick. Over.
Dick, I know this is going to shut off any second, but if you look at a Motorola, when you buy a Motorola adapter to go to an outside antenna, it has a network in there. They actually give you a matching network to bring you out to 50 ohms. Also, Motorola's radiating the best because Motorola has made the chassis.